May God bless to our understanding the further opening of this word. Now, today's scripture can initially seem very distant. I tried for days to come up with an analogous situation, and it's really hard. Although the situation Paul described was, in a way, about food, in other ways, it really wasn't about food at all. It certainly was different from what the dynamics might be today if we had a mixed company of meat eaters and vegans and vegetarians at a table. There are some things in common, of course, and it's usually possible for a gracious host to go out of their way and provide meals that work for everyone, but these days, when we disagree about what we eat, it's usually for environmental or ethical or health reasons. We don't usually have religious disagreements about what we eat. Yeah, today we're worlds away from the temple sacrifices of Paul's time. The temple sacrifices from which this letter comes, our meat comes from non-religious sources, for that matter, so do our vegetables. Often they come wrapped in colorful logos that ensure FDA approval and expiration date and a certain number of milligrams of vitamins or minerals. Or maybe they come from the farmer's market, wrapped in paper that might be very plain to the eye, but which still tells stories to the imagination, stories of the wholesomeness of that food's origin. The only time we generally notice a food's spiritual origin is if it's stamped kosher or halal. And those little stamps of approval generally blend in next to all the other stamps like grain-fed, organic, and a good source of vitamin X, and 32% more fiber than other leading brands. Although the butcher or the farmer might have private prayers that they say when they take the life of a chicken or when they behead a lettuce, those prayers are not often shared with us, the consumers. But in Paul's time, religion was practiced in the public square, and that was also where your meat met its fate. Gods and goddesses were pleased by the scent of blood and burnt meat mingled with incense and rising to their divine nostrils above the squares and temples of the city, whether those sacrifices were made to one god in Jerusalem or to many gods in Rome. And of course, this made things complicated for monotheists. What if you were Jewish, but you were living in Rome, trying to keep kosher in the midst of multiple pagan temples? You could always butcher your own chickens in your backyard, but you wouldn't always know where other people got their meat from. And life usually requires us to encounter other people. Imagine being invited to a meal in mixed company, maybe a new church community. Imagine if it was hosted by a stranger who may or may not have been Jewish like you, who may or may not keep kosher like you, and who in fact may or may not have purchased today's meat at a pagan temple. You'd probably feel just as uncomfortable as someone with food allergies might feel today being invited to a church potluck and trying to figure out which food won't give you hives. It's a vulnerable place to be in, trying to ask politely, not to seem rude, but to clearly find out whether you can partake in this shared meal. Think about the awkward apologies you get when someone says, "Yeah, sorry, it's got gluten in it," or the judgmental looks you get, on the other hand, from people who think your dietary restrictions are illogical or unhealthy. Being an invited guest at a meal prepared by strangers is a very vulnerable place to be in, and if you've ever experienced it, you can understand. These are hard situations to be in, but if you think of them another way, they also, because of that, can seem very noble. Imagine the self-control needed to be a diabetic at an ice cream social. There's something heroic about sticking to your principles even when the social pressure is hard. And you might remember some other stories in the Bible that speak to that experience. Queen Esther, who is secretly a Jew living in Persian exile, confesses that she skips the toasts, the libations raised to foreign gods at the royal feasts. The prophet Daniel and his buddies Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who also lived in exile before they more famously got thrown to the lions and into the fiery furnace, also had a bit of a reputation for what they ate. They limited themselves to eating vegetables and drinking water so that they wouldn't be compromised by meat or wine dedicated to other gods. And God rewarded them miraculously by keeping their bodies strong and fit, much to the chagrin of their jailers who expected them to waste away on this plain diet. But even if you're not imprisoned by a hostile enemy, it takes courage and commitment to stick to a diet. No matter the reasons, sacred or secular, whether you're going gluten-free as a health experiment or whether you're going vegan to combat climate change, it's hard to stick to a diet. And it's especially hard to stick to a diet when you are in the minority or when you are the only one in a group of others who would like to share the fellowship of the table with you. So we can understand that position, but actually that wasn't the position that Paul was in. Paul had been an observant Jew. Earlier in his life, he would have known the difficulties of keeping kosher in a pagan context, but by the time he wrote Romans, Paul and his fellow apostles had discerned a call from God to move beyond kosher laws. Jesus had planted the seed of this change, of course, when he redefined what it meant to keep Sabbath, when he challenged the rules about hand washing and the rules about social purity. But the other apostles took it further. Peter had a vision from God, directly offering him a range of unclean animals, quote, unclean, and telling him to kill them and eat them. Meanwhile, Paul began to minister more and more to the Gentile population, which forced him to focus on parts of Christ's message that made sense in a non-Jewish context. So, all this to say, by the time Paul wrote Romans, he and his community of disciples probably didn't keep kosher anymore. They might not even have observed the Sabbath. Scholars go back and forth about which parts of which laws they would or would not have obeyed, but the letter to the Romans makes it clear. Whatever you eat, whatever you do not eat, makes no difference. Just do what you feel God calls you to do, and do it with all your heart. But not all Christians saw it the same way. Others continued to be fully Christian and fully Jewish, observing the law as strictly as they could. And so, because their church was made up of sub-communities with different practices, Paul had to find ways to hold them together. And so Paul wrote these words of caution over and over again. He wrote them in different words. Sometimes he said, all things are allowed, but not all things are helpful. And sometimes he said, why do you pass judgment on your brother or your sister? Why do you despise your brother or your sister? And over again, he said, do not place a stumbling block in front of a brother or sister for whom Christ died. In plainest of plain speech, I'd like to offer the following summary of Paul's basic message in these texts. I think what Paul was saying was this: some of you are right, and some of you are wrong, but it doesn't matter how right you are if you're a jerk about it. So, for Christ's sake, and I'm not swearing, I'm invoking Christ for real, for Christ's sake and for the sake of the gospel, please, just don't be a jerk. I know this is what he meant, because whenever I read the genuine letters of Paul in the Bible, I hear this message coming to me over and over. Or maybe I should just fess up and admit that I hear this message over and over because I really need to learn this message. I like to blame it on growing up in New York City, but however I came by my attitude, I surely did learn at a young age that some people are right and some people are wrong. And by this I mean I learned how to be self-righteous. And I'll bring it back to the dinner table, and I'll bring it back to now, and I will tell you that I am a self-righteous composter. I am self-righteous about how I compost all my food scraps. I will even sometimes carry them home so that I can compost them. I'm surprised that Alameda County didn't want to put my face on the bus and the BART ads telling people your dinner's not done until you compost your food scraps. Did you know you could also compost dryer lint and paper towels? Composting is the right short thing to do. I am sure of it. But Talitha, it doesn't matter how right you are if you're a jerk about it. Recently, I was at my sister's house in Seattle, and we were cutting up food for dinner. Specifically, I was cutting up bell peppers. And you know how a bell pepper has a chunk of stuff in the middle, that all the white bits and all the seeds? You can't eat that, but you sure can compost it. My sister saw me looking around the kitchen for the compost, and she regretfully explained to me that they were not currently composting. Since the arrival of the new baby, etc., they've just been busy, and turning over the compost in the garden hasn't happened. Can you imagine it? So there's no room in the bin, and they aren't lucky enough to have curbside compost. Oh well. Fast forward 10 minutes later, and I'm still standing there with pepper seeds and white bits on my cutting board, making conversation, you know, having a glass of wine, pushing the bits around on the cutting board, because, in actual fact, I am not capable of throwing the pepper bits into the garbage. They're compostable! So I'm standing there, hoping she'll relent between nursing her new infant and chasing a toddler and say, oh, you know what, I guess we could compost that after all. I'll go dig out some space in the bin. But my sister did not do that. She somehow was impervious to my ecological shame. She stood her ground, and she dared me to throw it into the garbage. And she lovingly laughed at me for that squirm of judgment she saw in my face. It doesn't matter how good a composter you are if you use a pile of bell pepper seeds to try to shame your sister for whom Christ died. I want to invite you all to look at your bulletin and use the Mad Libs feature on the sermon title, Confessions of a Self-Righteous Fill-in-the-Blank. Well, what is it for you? Fill in that blank and give it your best shot. What are you really awesome at? I'm good at composting, but you have other talents. What are you the best at? Are you just the best grammar police around? Are you in such amazing physical shape that less fit people feel embarrassed just looking at your biceps? Are you really good at planting local plants wherever you go and ripping out invasive species? Are you a whiz at evaluating politicians for ideological purity? There has got to be something that that you are so good at that you're at risk of having a big old blind spot for self-righteousness. Some of us are right, And some of us are wrong, but it doesn't matter how right you are if you think this makes you better than the others for whom Christ also died. So, what do you want? Do you want to be the best composter in the world, or do you want to have friends? Do you want to be right, or do you want to be part of a community? I'd rather have friends. I'd rather have a community. Whenever we think we're better than someone else, even if it's for perfectly legitimate reasons, we break community. To use Paul's language, we set up a stumbling block, which is the same Greek word from which we get our word scandal. We put a scandal in their path, something that stops them in their tracks, trips them up, and makes them fall away. We might lose one person, one precious person for whom Christ died, or we may lose a whole bunch of them who get tripped up and scared off. Whenever we think we're better than someone else, we break community. And we can keep breaking it down until we end up locked in a tiny community, just a couple of people who act and think just like us. The answer, friends, is, you will not be surprised, the answer is love. We've been saying love over and over again already throughout this service. But that's Paul's answer too. If we approach one another with love instead of with righteousness, we can create a gracious community, a community that can support gluten-free, vegan, meat-eating, pagan, Jewish, and everybody together. We can create a gracious community in which there's room for difference of opinions and differences of practices, a community where we can hold everyone together, whether we agree or disagree. Love covers a multitude of sins. So if you wrote in a Mad Libs fill in the blank on your bulletin, just take your pen now and write love in big letters over it. Cross out your self-righteousness. God's love is big enough to hold us all together. So let's stop seeing each other as right and wrong. Instead, just look at one another with God's eyes, seeing how loved we really are. And then maybe we can learn to give that love and to hold our community together with that love. May it be so.